This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 5:05 in the evening, and our first story of the day is about a tribunal that's hoping to set higher standards of accountability for our electoral commissioners.
So this tribunal we're referring to was set up to investigate allegations of misconduct by six former Election Commission members. It's the first of its kind in Malaysia and also in the Commonwealth. The members were appointed by the Yang di-Pertuan Agong, and it was set up after Electoral Watchdog Bersih 2.0 had lodged a complaint post GE14. The tribunal members are five retired judges from the federal court.
So the hope here, from Bersih at least, is that the tribunal would help send a strong message that public officials who handle elections will be held accountable if they neglect certain standards in their duties. They also said in their statement, this could be the starting point to actually rectify the flaws in our electoral system.
Especially in how EC members are appointed. They want to ensure that only candidates who are truly independent and competent make the cut. This tribunal is also seen to signal that the practice of winning elections by hook or by crook, which is a phrase we heard come from PPBM recently, will no longer be tolerated.
A couple of months ago, the current chairman of the EC, Azhar Harun, spoke on The Morning Run about electoral reforms. Here he brings us a few simple but crucial traits that future election commission members need to possess.
I think an impartial EC must be independent from the influence and interference of political parties. We must act in accordance with the law. We must be fair. And fairness is entrenched in the law. If you look at the 13th schedule of the Constitution, fairness is entrenched there. So it is not an alien concept, you know. So we just have to follow the provision of the law. And I think that would bring the perception of fairness. It's as simple as that. I will try, of course, to, to find people who are actually qualified for the job. I think that's the first thing, you know. They must be qualified. They must know the law. They must know the process. They must have the passion. And then they must have this commitment for being fair and rule and legal and law-abiding people, you know.
And I think that this is just the very latest in a long-running, a long-running surge or need for electoral reform. It's part of it, right? It's part of what we've been constantly talking about. And judging by the by-elections that we have seen, yep. Since May 9th, there is clearly a lot of... there's clearly a lot more understanding that needs to be had in terms of what would constitute clean elections, in terms of what a good or solid, super solid election commission would look like, what that needs to be. So there is all that. But with this tribunal in particular, I mean, I guess I'm wondering what it is that they're trying to solve in the short term.
So based on what I read, I think the understanding is to address some of the problems that they saw post GE14. But when they met yesterday, there was a lot of confusion that happened because I think one of the lawyers from the AG chambers said that the reason why we're meeting is because of the past EC members who have now resigned. So what we're discussing is purely academic. So I think some people involved in the process find that they may not be an actual strong point to meeting, but we'll see what the next meeting will look like, because I think yesterday when they met, it just ended up in confusion mostly.
Yeah, and I understand that confusion, because when I read about it or when I was looking at it, well, the initial knee-jerk response is,
wow, great,
a tribunal, excellent, you know, this is more movement in the right direction. The second rather rapid thought was, oh, but, you know, if they've resigned and if all these separate sort of rules are being put into place already about what we hope to see, it does feel rather academic. It does feel a little bit, you know, after the fact, let's come and write a paper about what happened. I hope that isn't necessarily the case, but you're right, we'll wait and see. In the meantime, our next story focuses on financial scams.
Now, as I said, Irene, the government is going to make you pay a tax on the prize. But if you buy the Waterson 2000 water filtration system, the prize gets recorded as a sales expense and you don't pay any tax. Good deal, huh?
Yeah.
So anyway, the latest scam to hit us has to do with the TAC code, which is the transaction authorization code. Anyone who's ever had any online banking done will be familiar with this. It's the unique 6-digit code that the bank sends to your registered mobile phone number. Usually you have to key that code in before your transaction is approved, stopping people who are not you from using your account, basically. Especially since the scammers here would not only need your credit card details, they need your phone as well.
So assuming that you have your phone safely with you, how would the scam work? Well, it turns out scammers, we know this, are a brazen lot. Dato' Saiful Azli Kamarudin, acting director at the Bukit Aman Commercial Crime Investigation Department, has warned that what happens is these guys pretty much call you and ask for it. So they pretend that the card, their card was mistakenly registered to your number, perhaps, you know, whatever, because your mobile number is almost identical to theirs, or, you know, they switched numbers recently, or at least that's what they'll say.
So in all these scenarios, they use politeness to take advantage of your kindness and desire to help, being all apologetic, saying they have urgent bills to pay, and then escalating from there. And it might sound like a scam that you wouldn't fall for, but TAC scams are prevalent and on the rise. Here's Dato' Saifli with some details on the scammers and just how much money has been lost via these scams.
When we siasat, kebanyakannya the IP address of the phone number is in overseas, not in Malaysia. So nasihat saya pada semua, kalau ada yang minta tag, kecuali you sendiri yang buat that belian, abaikan. For 2017, we have 202 cases of tag number being misused. 2018, we have the 392 cases. And till today, for this year, we have 33 cases. For 2017, jumlah kerugian is 11.6 million. Last year, 14.9 million. And this year, till today, 18 days already, 441,000 already.
That was Dato' Saiful Azli Kamarudin, acting director at the Bukit Aman Commercial Crime Investigation Department. Now, the thing here is that preventing these tax scams or TAC scams is actually easy, but only if everyone understands the fact that codes like this cannot be wrongly sent to a different number. A credit card is tied to the cardholder's phone number, which means that all SMS notifications are sent to that specific number and nowhere else.
So a scammer might try to confuse you by saying it's the bank who failed to make the updates or register the right number. But if that's really the reason, it's the individual's responsibility to go back to the bank to update their info and seek clarification. It's definitely not acceptable to call your number and ask for the code.
So in essence, this is a bit of a public service message. That's really the only reason I wanted to talk about this, because it sounds like the kind of scam that I can see a lot of people, you know, in a rush or assuming the best of people, how they might fall for it. But this is what it comes down to, all right? If someone calls you saying that their TAC code has been missent to your number, there is no need to lie on this request. Do not. If they need the code urgently, the bank's number exists, they can find it, and then they can call them and sort it out. So that really is the answer to this whole thing.
And this really applies to other things as well, because two-factor authentications now apply to other things beyond banking, like your email address, your social media accounts. So the scam also works there, because through that they can call you and say, hey, I'm trying to get into my email, or I'm trying to get into my Instagram account, but, you know, again, the number is tied, my account is tied to your number, could you give me the code? So these scams do happen there as well.
So that's the thing. I mean, I remember reading an article recently that suggested that two-factor authentication is not the be-all end-all of security, really.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's long been thought that it is, but it's quite easy for people to fish your passwords, for people to, you know, to end up doing things like this. I mean, if you look at really the anatomy of the scam, it is so simple.
Yeah.
It's really simple. It's just calling people up and saying, hi, you know that number that was just sent to you? Yeah, that was a mistake. Please give it to me.
Yeah.
And it's such a pain after that to try and sort it out. So yeah, again, if you get a tag code, a TAC code sent to you, you're not doing any transactions, but it gets sent and then somebody follows up and says, hi, that number you just got, can I have it? No. The answer is just no. We would like to hear from you, though, about your experiences with scams of this sort, or any scams at all. Have you managed to outsmart people? Have you accidentally found yourself falling prey to these things? We would love to hear from you. Let us know. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. We have this from Dr. RK regarding the tribunal. Finally, the former Arran's high-ranking EC members are being tribunalized. Padamuka, the EC must not only be impartial, but must be seen to be impartial as well. Emulate India's election commission that is fearless. Art Harun is doing a good job.
And such a breath of fresh air after so long of seeing our EC, I guess, basically become just another arm of the government.
Yes, that's very true. So keep those thoughts coming about electoral reforms and fairness, about financial scams that you might have heard of. Let us know. This is kind of a public service sharing. Let people know the scams so that everyone can kind of steer clear of them. Again, that number to WhatsApp, 018-789-8899. You can, of course, also tweet us at BFM Radio. And for our next story, we want to start off with, you know, just first up, a question. And it might seem like a bit of a basic, simple one, but it's important. And, you know, we'll tell you why. But this question is, why do you work?
I don't like my job, and I don't think I'm going to go anymore.
You're just not going to go?
Yeah.
Won't you get fired?
I don't know. But I really don't like it, and I'm not going to go.
So every time we talk about work, the issue of purpose tends to come up. The idea that it might not just be a paycheck that's driving you, but instead a sense of believing in the company or the work or the mission. But an article from the BBC is suggesting that we should be focusing on the how we work as opposed to the why.
So the modern version of how we work is one that's pretty familiar to a lot of us. I think we sit in lots of meetings per week or per day. We stay connected to the office via our emails and our phones constantly. And as recent research suggests, we even work on our sick days thanks to this, you know, non-stop connectivity.
So the average working day has lengthened by 2 hours. By some estimates, workers who are expected to stay connected to their colleagues are clocking up over 70 hours plugged into the office each week. And half the people who add a couple of extra hours to the working day clock up the highest recordable levels of stress.
And of course, so many bosses, increasingly trying to appeal to a millennial workforce, focus on the purpose of the company, trying to make it so that everyone's working with this purpose, this mission. But that in turn seems to be causing dissatisfaction on the, you know, overworked shop floor, so to speak, with the dissonance of, you know, why am I working at this noble, amazing, purpose-driven company, but I'm still unhappy?
So we're seeing an increasing number of workers taking their employers to task on the disparities between what was promised to them as candidates and the realities of their jobs. The Google walkout in 2018 followed Susan Fowler's Uber blog posts as another high-profile milestone on a long road of workplace discontent, despite lofty answers to the answer of why work here.
So the solution then seems to be, let's not work on the why work here, let's work on the how do we work here? How do we work? Focusing on that can be quite an empowering thing, at least giving people autonomy to try to make their working experiences better. So Inc. magazine spoke to Barry Schwartz, psychology professor and author of Why We Work, and he said basically we just need to rethink the whole concept.
You say that we as a society have absorbed some false assumptions about our relationship with work. Is it that we have absorbed them, accepted them, really, or is it just no alternative has been presented?
I think it's kind of like fish not knowing they live in water. I don't think we've accepted them. I think we've basically come to believe that this is the way work is. You know, the driving force is efficiency. We want to maximize efficiency, maximize productivity, and in that way maximize profit, and that means a fatter pay envelope. Well, how do you maximize efficiency? You routinize work so that people kind of become interchangeable parts. You don't need to spend a lot of time and money training them. Somebody's sick, it's easy for somebody else to step into the role. And so, yeah, I hate my work, but my paycheck is 20% higher. You could imagine people deciding, it's a trade-off I want to make. I would rather make more money and hate my work than make less money and love my work. Mm-hmm. But it's actually a false trade-off, that the evidence is that workplaces where people can be engaged, develop, feel autonomous, and get some meaning are actually the most productive workplaces. So if you create workplaces like that, not only are the people happier during the day, but the company is more successful.
So some other suggestions, you know, we can all probably agree that meetings need to be shorter, and apparently halving the number of attendees goes a long way towards making meetings more efficient. Investment bankers Bridgewater Associates found that fewer people at meetings vastly improved the quality of discussions.
Yeah, I don't find that surprising. The challenge, of course, there was that some people then had meeting FOMO, you know, the fear of missing out, convinced that other meetings, the meetings that they weren't at, those were the ones that were more important. Those were the ones where people were discussing all, you know, the big groundbreaking stuff. So to prove that this was misplaced, Bridgewater Associates started recording all their meetings with the end result that no one complained when they were stood down from the attendee list.
Other ideas included taking a proper lunch break, taking a walk to grab coffee with a colleague, and having a social meeting, one where people are encouraged to socialize with one another during working hours, which leads to more collaboration during the rest of the week.
So I really liked this article because I think it takes the reality of work away from the more airy-fairy thoughts of why do we work? What is the purpose? You know, and instead focuses on the fact that regardless of the purpose, the point is that you are going into a building or an office most days of your life, and we should focus on how to make the time spent in there not just more productive, but also just better, you know, how it's not just about, I guess it's not just about company outcomes, because when you focus on the why, it's always about company goals.
Yeah, I think the article made a great point where when they said that, you know, I'm doing this really fulfilling work, I'm contributing to greater achievements that could probably improve the world, but you don't understand why you're unhappy. And then it doesn't help that you have some CEO saying, well, the work you're doing is fulfilling. We're doing great things here. But then you kind of feel bad for feeling bad about and not understanding why you feel bad about the work that you're doing.
Yeah, it's a very, you know, kind of long-winded, long-winding conversation that you need to have in order to just fundamentally realize, well, I'm unhappy maybe because I'm overworked. Yeah. I'm unhappy maybe because I don't like an open office. And I mean, I think we've spoken before about the fact that we work in an open office, and while our boss, you know, enjoys it, I think enjoys the fact that at any point anybody can just drop in and have a conversation. I think for people who are perhaps more introverted, for people who are perhaps just, you know, more sound sensitive, open offices are just the worst.
This is my first ever office-like experience, so I really don't have any other bar to measure it against. But so far, it's been all right, but I wish the office had more quiet spaces where we could work in because, yeah, you know, having it be a flat design makes it great for conversations, makes it great for collaboration. But when you really want to get down to do the work, or when you really want to get down to start thinking about how you get around certain content and how you want to, you know, get solutions to problems, the quietness of it seems to help.
Yeah, I think having room to have a discussion and then having room to kind of go away is important. But it all comes down to, I guess, having a workspace in which you can figure out the how, right? Yeah. Where it's not so circumscribed, where it's like, hey, okay, you're just here from 9 to 6. You will be where we need you to be. You will do what we need you to do. And I think making small adjustments to your workplace and to your work habits is important. I find that the whole taking a walk thing is great. I make a point of taking a walk when I can, sometimes to get lunch, sometimes just after a little bit to offset the lunch sleepies. I also find that having plants on my table actually has been a way of improving the how for me, because it just makes me that much happier.
I take window breaks, as in I take a break from looking at my screen and I just stare out into the outdoors. I think the sunlight really helps me out.
Let us know. I mean, how are you making the how of how you work a little bit better? How are you making your days, you know, just a little more enjoyable, more productive in the workplace? What are the little things and tricks that you do? But also let us know, do you agree in general that the how of working is just as important, if not more, than the why?
So we sent our interns out and they got to speak to some of the residents of Taman Tun for their thoughts.
Why do you work where you work?
At the time, I'd only just graduated. I just got out of a bad breakup, so I was a bit lost. And so a friend offered me a job, and so this is where I ended up.
You do work hard, but you get a lot of benefits, and the company recognizes the hard work. So far, been great.
A lot of people think that advertising is all about trying to make people buy what they shouldn't really buy. But I think in advertising, we get to share our point of view on a lot of things and inspire people to do better, inspire change.
I always felt that I want to make the world a better place with what I do.
Do you have any pet peeves on how your company is run?
I can't really say pet peeve in the sense that, because this is a global role that we have, so we work all sorts of time zones. It can be from 7 a.m. to 3 a.m., and then the workload just keeps on expanding. So I think it's a regular pet peeve that a lot of employees would face, but especially in a global environment, you can't really complain much about it because you knew what you were accepting.
The three key things that they should look into is the humanity, the experience, taking care of their people, and the overall politics regulation of things.
I think the most important aspect in a company is communication between the different levels. So you got like your bosses, and then you got your like your workers. So if everybody's on the same level and accomplishing the same goal, I think that would be a suitable working environment for everybody.
I think maybe we can have a nap in between the work time, because working relentlessly throughout the day is quite tiring for me.
What would you like to do differently to improve your working experience?
How on earth do I do less work and actually more thinking?
Take the Asian out of myself, in the sense that, and now especially we're working with a lot of people from all over the world, we tend to be a lot more yes men in that sense, and I'd like to just step away from that and put my foot down where I need to.
Not burn myself out, no matter what.
I would like to have my own personal space so I can, you know, set my own time and do my work and my own will, yeah.
Well, I wish there was more hours in the day.
Do you believe in spending time or socializing with your colleagues outside of work?
We all the time. Otherwise, we'd lose our sanity. With the hours we work, we always make that time, and we use that time to vent to each other, so we realize that we're all in the same boat and it's all good.
My 5 days a week, I'm already spending a lot of time with my colleagues. So my colleagues are technically my second family members. They're not blood, but still family members because we work in a team.
I think it's important to get to know the people that you work with so you can have a better working relationship. Yeah, because, you know, the people that you work with, you end up spending a lot of time with them and they end up becoming your family too.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.